This is R.J. Rushdoony, Easy Chair number 339, May the 23rd, 1995. This evening we have a particularly interesting interview for you, plus some very remarkable people with us. First of all, Paul Biddle. You're all familiar with him because we have written about him. He has written for the report, and you've read about him in the papers, how he took on Stanford University, found that they had been misusing funds for national defense, and is currently in the courts trying to recover that money from the federal government. Then we have John Stuess with us. John himself has a remarkable story, and sometime, John, we'd like to have you come and we'll interview you, because I feel your story needs to be told. John Stuess has been very active in California on a number of fronts, including the political front. Then, of course, Andrew Sandlin, and Mark Rushdoony, and myself. This evening we're going to interview someone whose life story, and he's a young man, is quite an unusual and an intensely interesting one. Theron Johnson is with us. Theron has had quite a background. He is currently a United Airlines pilot. Before that, he was in the U.S. Air Force, and he was in Arabia, in Saudi Arabia, and took part in the Gulf War. And I think it would be especially interesting, Theron, to hear a little bit about your experiences there in Arabia, how Saudi Arabia treats Americans, and whether anything is ever done about it.
Okay. My time in the Gulf War, you have to understand, before that, I was stationed in Saudi Arabia on three-week deployments, several years before Desert Storm or Desert Shield. As you know, the Muslim culture is vastly different than the United States. They treat, in a nutshell, to make it simple, they treat Americans as if we're their servants. They don't like, the culture is based upon third world countries doing their labor in Saudi Arabia, and then they rely on the Europeans and the Americans to do all their technological or technical work for them. During the course of the war, weren't treated very well. I'm sure you saw a lot of the news articles and interviews from the American troops. That was just a tip of the iceberg when you have such a clash of cultures with people running into each other in that way. A lot of the soldiers were not very enthusiastic as the war progressed, as they saw how we were being treated by the Saudis, not very appreciative of our presence.
I remember seeing when the troops were sent over, there was, you know, lists of things that you couldn't take and all the restrictions, and that sort of struck me as odd, that a country that we were going and sending our boys to defend would set up all these restrictions. Do you have any other examples of things that happened while you were there?
Well, interesting thing when you bring up customs, it brings back a lot of memories, bad memories. Before the war, when we would go to the country, we had to have special passports. It would take us hours to get through customs, especially the women, because they would be especially thorough going through their luggage. if they found anything that they liked or wanted, they would say it was, it couldn't enter the country, and they would confiscate it. It was exactly the opposite during the war, because they wanted us in the country to defend them. So there was no customs to speak of. So we just came into the country, were established in our billets, and went about fighting the war. So it was 180 degrees.
You told me some interesting stories about Saudi justice towards Americans. Perhaps you could repeat one of them, or more. The one about the...
Well, I'll tell you the one about the car accident.
Yes.
There was an American who... a Saudi ran a red light and broadsided an American in their car. And there was a car... flipped the car. The Saudi was wrong. In America, he would have been cited, and the American would have gone about his business. Well, in Saudi Arabia, when the policeman showed up, he did write the Saudi a ticket, but he also wrote the American a ticket. And the reason he said that he wrote the American a ticket says that this accident would not have occurred if you had not been in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
And the American lost in court,
yes.
No doubt.
And
yes.
There's another case of a Saudi, some connection to the royal family is the way I understand it. I went to a gas station, you have to understand, I can't remember what it's called, their prayer calls during the day. Well, all the shops and stores have to close down when they have the prayer call. Well, a Saudi went into a gas station and wanted gas right at prayer call. Well, like I said before, all their labor is third world, Pakistani, Filipino. And if they are caught violating these laws, they are punished severely. Well, when a Saudi came in during prayer call and wanted gas, he didn't. This is a Pakistani or Sri Lankan, I can't remember exactly, but he wouldn't sell the Saudi gas. Well, they pursued to get into an argument, and the Saudi pulled a gun on the Pakistani, and they began to struggle, and in the course of the struggle, the gun went off and killed a woman in a nearby car. The Saudi was fined, I can't remember the amount, but he was fined and released. The Pakistani was put on trial for murder, and was scheduled he was scheduled to be executed. And at the time, we were trying to raise money for his defense, because he wasn't going to get a defense. And the reason that they put him up for the death penalty was they said that if he had sold the man gas, then that woman would not be dead. So there's many cases of they caught a Saudi who was raping and killing Filipino nurses and putting them in dumpsters. They caught him, and they would not take the testimony of Filipino witnesses, because they said they were infidels, and they wouldn't take that testimony. So that man walked. And I don't know if you remember, this is back when Aquino threatened to bring all the Filipinos home from Saudi Arabia. So that's a small taste of Saudi justice.
When you came back, you went into the United Airlines as a pilot, didn't
yes.
you? Mm-hmm. And you're still with United.
Yes, I still fly with United Airlines.
You live currently in Sacramento, I believe.
Yes.
And you're a member of the Reformed Church there, I believe.
Yes, a new member of the Covenant Reformed Church of Sacramento.
Yes. And John, you're a member of that church.
Yeah, and we appreciate your work, because it was basically through some of the writings of Cal Seaton that Ben got interested in the church and started attending, and we've had the pleasure of having him in our home quite regularly, and to watch him grow in the Lord's been a real joy.
One of the things that is notable about Theron is that he has a very strong faith, a reformed faith. And he is also intensely interested in politics because he is disgusted with what he sees on all sides. What are you doing about that, Theron?
Oh, I'm planning on running for Congress in Sacramento, from the district in Sacramento in 1996. I've been over the last several years, as John said, your writings have influenced me greatly in making this step. I've also been studying the issues so that I would be prepared to be a credible candidate in this run for Congress. And as you said, the situation now in politics in this country is disgusting. But I look at it, and you've said this before, we're approaching what you call a crisis. And as a Chinese ideograph says, it's a combination of opportunity and danger.
Yes.
And, we could go either way, depending on whether or not, Christians decide to step up and run for offices. I've had people ask me, why are you getting involved in politics? Everybody's slimy and sleazy and all these bad things. I said, well, you just answered the question.
Theron, what qualities can you bring to this office that either the incumbent or other candidates cannot?
Responsibility, ethics, initiative. The willingness to see that there's a problem and act on that, to do something positive to change. The thing that's going to, that put me over the top as far as wanting to run is definitely my faith, my Christian faith, because that is the foundation of what I'm going to run on is going to be a Christian response to what we're seeing in politics. I think that's been a weakness in the conservative movement. They'll say, well, we want to cut taxes, and we want to get rid of welfare, but they have nothing to, to take its place to respond to it. Whereas I'm going to say, we want to get rid of welfare, but we want to get rid of that, we must strengthen the family. The family has to step in and take its the place, that God wants it to take, and not look to the state for everything, for all handouts or to take care of them. That's an important part.
Paul, you have had more familiarity with the political scene than probably you would like to recall. Do you have any suggestions and comments and counsel for Theron?
Well, I would only go back to when I ran for Congress, and that is be faithful to your principles. And I would emphasize be in fear of God and live in His ways. When I was running for Congress, I read many of the things that Rush had put together over his good life. And often when I would go before groups to speak to them, they would feel that you wouldn't cleave to where you should be, and if you were questioned, you would sort of move to their side. And I believe one of the first telling interviews was when they asked me, they said, "Are you a Christian?" And I said, "Yes." And they said, "Are you a conservative?" And I said, "Yes." And then they went into the issue of right to life and so on. We had five candidates there, and I was the only one who would characterize himself as a Christian. Now, I'm sure they had gone to church, but they would not put their foot on the step and say what they were. And I think as people realize what we are, we will attract more people than we will cause to go away from us. But I think you're really an outstanding fellow to take on this challenge, and it's really a challenge. But keep the faith, so to speak, on what you are and what you want to be and what you want to deliver to your people. The constituency up in Sacramento, I think they have a good chance of getting a good congressman out of you.
I think it's an interesting time where the district in Sacramento is one that the political professionals would say is an impossible district. It's an urban center. It's got all the problems that the liberals are designed to solve. And yet the people there are starting to react much the same way as we're seeing the revolution around the country. We interviewed with Star Parker, who's a black activist in Los Angeles, who's got a dynamic testimony of coming to the Lord and then having her pastor challenge her to get off of welfare and then just in obedience doing it cold turkey. And she went out and started a business and turned out to be a pretty good marketer and had a little local newspaper. And when the Los Angeles riots took place is when her political revolution took place, because here she was at home literally watching the businesses that she derived her living from, and she knew other black families derived their living from, burning to the ground. And in the next scene, Maxine Waters, the black leader for Los Angeles as a congresswoman, was standing there saying that these were just troubled youth and that they needed a way to express themselves. And that completely turned Star around. And what we're finding is that in these liberal bastions, by the press's estimation, it is conservatives that are starting to come to the forefront, and these people are rising up saying, of course we're strong in the family, and of course we're strong in the church. And I think it's a real opportunity for an American reformation of some real proportions, because it's only as we go back to biblical principles that we've got any real answers for these inner city problems.
Well, the past weekend and until yesterday, I was in Opelousas, Louisiana. It was a marvelous trip. I thoroughly enjoyed the people there, Cajuns mostly. And of course, I met a rather select group, I would have to say. But I was impressed by the number of lawyers who were present, as well as men in politics, including one of the candidates for governor. And one of the things, Theron, and this really surprised me, was how many of them were disgusted with the unwillingness of men to be Christian in their stand. And he, the candidate for governor, was unabashedly a Christian, and I thought, I believe there's something happening in this country. And I realized I had been seeing this happen here and there across country in my travels, that men were making a stand not just as a conservative or as a liberal or Democrat or Republican, whatever the case might be, but were specifically Christian. I think it is an indication that the time is rapidly coming when people are going to have to be counted in terms of their basic faith, their willingness to make a stand, their readiness in some instances to go to jail for the stand they make. And John, you know what I'm talking about.
He's put up a lot of money.
Yes. And sometime we'll have to get your story. But there is a definite change underway. Tell us a little bit about your family, because I think it's interesting that your father was an Air Force man and retired from the Air Force.
Yes, he initially joined the Air Force. He enlisted, and through a program that the Air Force had, they they sent him to college. He went to Arizona State to get his degree in the medical lab technician. We were stationed mainly in the Southwest, Texas, Arizona, California. Did a lot of moving around, and he retired, and still, you know, when you retire from the Air Force, you're still a young, I mean, 40, he was 45 when he retired from the Air Force, so he's still working. My mother is also, they all live, well, my whole family lives in, they're still living in Houston. Mm-hmm. My brother's a police officer in Houston. My sisters, one's a nurse and the other one's an interior designer, and they're all down in Houston. My brother and I are the only true conservatives in the family.
Now, in the Sacramento area, you have a problem in that you have a great deal of bureaucracy there, state bureaucracy.
It's our only growth industry in Sacramento.
What do you have to say to the Sacramento bureaucracy?
Well, I haven't had much contact with them, so I haven't had much to say to them. Mm-hmm. I'm busy trying to get grassroots support right now. Mm-hmm. The way I envision it would be to build my grassroots, raise my money, and then go to the bureaucracy or go to the party leadership and say, this is what I have, this is what I've, you know, built, you know, do you want to support me, you know, and basically put in a frame where it'd be nice to have you come along, but, you know, I don't want to go in, you know, needing them to you know, finance my campaign or keep me going. Mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, we're doing a little opposite of where most people do. They go around and want to meet all the big wigs and head honchos, whereas I'm fairly content to go around and meet the people that, you know, I'm going to be representing.
I'm glad to hear you say that. What is the nature of your district?
As far as the breakup, Republicans and Democrats, it's two-thirds Democrat. A lot of low-income areas. It's basically the city of Sacramento. So there's a lot of labor there in town, a lot of, as John says, bureaucrats, government workers. But the approach that we're going to take, as I said before, is going to be a Christian platform. We're going to have to go after issues that cut across party lines, and those are going to be, we're going to address education, we're going to address jobs or employment, the fact that the government overregulates and overtaxes, and, you know, destroys the jobs, hurts the economy, and we're going to talk about balancing the budget, fiscal responsibility, which is the overall, you know, to give, and all those issues really address the family. Is if you address those issues, and we turn those around, then that makes it a better environment that'll be conducive to people getting jobs, supporting their families, being able to look into the future and say, you know, I can count on, you know, dollars still be worth, you know, being worth, you know, whatever it's worth now, 14 cents. But a dollar being worth a dollar, you know, 10, 20 years down the line, and not go with this you know, this insane overspending, you know, this debt we have approaching $5 trillion, and that's what they're telling us about. And the funny thing is how I came about my issues. I looked at the Communist Manifesto, which was a thing I thought would be the most anti-Christian document I could find, and I went in and picked a couple of issues. I mean, Marx wanted government control of education, mm-hmm. which we have now. He wanted a central bank, which we have now, and mm-hmm. is one of the reasons we're able to have the debt that we have is because of that centralized banking. And he wanted government control of industry, which is almost what we have now. So the way I looked at it, if we address those problems and started tearing down that his 10 points on his plank, and you know, having a Christian response to that, then that would be a good starting point.
What is the seat currently held by a Democrat or a Republican?
A very liberal Democrat.
Okay, then I think I know which one it is. I guess I don't need to answer. What do you anticipate to be the response of? Are you running as a Republican then?
Yes.
What do you anticipate to be the response of the party leadership?
Republican
yes,
leadership
towards your candidacy.
I think it all depends on what kind of team I build as far as setting up, getting the campaign set up. If I come in with money in the bank, a lot of volunteers, I think I'll get a good response. If I come in not prepared, I don't expect them to. I mean, I expect them to give me a response of, I mean, showing how much work I put into it. I look at a similar situation of Tim LaFever last year. He basically didn't get much support from the party, grassroots campaign, basically did it on his own. The party came in once they realized, hey, this guy's got a chance to win, but by then it was too late. He needed the support early. So I'm looking at it as a similar situation. I'm also looking at the fact that Matsui has been challenged. I mean, had a credible challenge against him, what, since 78?
Longer than I've lived in Sacramento.
So, and looking at his record, I can't see how, you know, like I said, coming in with a, you know, I'm going to show it as a opposite ends of the poll. I'm going to show him as the radical, far-out, left-wing nut, and I'm just a conservative, Christian candidate. And I think, and as you said, I want people to, make a choice. It'll be a very, a line drawn. It won't be anything, gray. It'll be black and white.
You've already had some interesting experiences in building your grassroots because of your profession. You get to strap in with seatbelts next to a pilot or a co-pilot for extended periods of time, and you haven't been shy about sharing your political ambitions. Maybe you could share a couple of the fun stories of your discussions in building support.
You call that a captive audience?
Well, some of the this was kind of an eye-opener for me. Thinking that I would be flying with conservatives. And I flew with a captain one day who his father helped set up the NAACP in Alaska. And we were, in the course of the discussion, we're talking, and he said, well, you're okay, you're conservative, just as long as you're not one of them crazy right-wing Christian fanatics.
What was your answer?
I said, I got bad news for you.
Baron, my feeling is that the tough campaign will be the primary. But if you win there, I think it'll be a shoo-in. Because I think you will pull a great many of the people who are registered as Democrats, but that the Republicans in your district will be some thoroughly entrenched liberal figures. Or am I wrong on that, John?
Ironically, you're probably right. It's the districts where we probably have the greatest what we call wedge issues. In other words, it's a difference in worldviews. I look at much as the reformers did when they walked into a medieval city and the children were alcoholics at the age of eight and stumbling in the streets and the venereal diseases were running rampant. They would write back and say, this town is ripe for revival. Mm-hmm. God's Spirit is about to do a great work.
And I think that needs to be our vision politically. It is the inner cities that are ripe for the Christian answers.
Yes.
We're the only ones that can give them hope and restore their families and restore their communities and put, you know, the bars and the prisons where they belong instead of the homes. I mean, I live in an inner city neighborhood and I take walks and it just breaks my heart to walk by a beautifully manicured yard and home with bars on the windows. And you can envision an elderly woman in just living in fear. And we can break those chains. And yet it's the political establishments that would look at that and they'd say, well, gosh, Theron, this is two-thirds Democrats and one-third Republican. The only way you could possibly win that district is act like a Democrat. So you've got to get rid of these social issues and you have to be moderate and you have to be, you know, for all these spending programs and you've got to just continue the things that have destroyed their lives. So it's going to take this kind of boldness, and I think we're starting to see it happen around the country.
Yes.
Where people stand up, and it'll be Christian people who stand up and say, hey, we've got some answers. You know, getting back to the obedience of God's word is going to have an impact on individual lives, family lives, and society. So, you know, that kind of boldness will not be warmly received at the Republican Federated Women's Clubs. But it certainly will get a warm, I think, reception when it's taken out to the neighborhoods and to the people that are there. Maybe Theron could share one exciting aspect we're working on right now is the alternatives to the public schools that are being done in some other areas that we hope to bring to Sacramento as part of this process.
Yes, one of the project I'm working on right now is a way for the low-income families to opt out of the public school system and send their children to private schools. It's a private voucher system. It would be a tax-exempt organization. I would take private donations, and what I would do would supplement low-income families, their incomes, 50% up to a certain dollar amount, and that would give them the option to let their children attend a private school. This system is working, is running in Milwaukee, Indianapolis,
yes.
Atlanta, Los Angeles, Oakland, San Antonio, and everywhere it's been started, it's had a tremendous reception from the families. And that's what we need to turn around the education system, is to get the parents involved. And if we give the parents the option, you know, a lot of people want to go after the public school system. I prefer in a military tactic to bypass them and hit them in the rear where they can't defend themselves. And that attack is basically competition. If people if they're superior, then people will choose the public schools. If they're not, and I don't think they will, they'll bail. You know, they'll leave them in droves. And you look at in the this last Sunday in the Sacramento Bee, there was an article, and this was supposedly an advanced school in the Sacramento School District, where the test was, it was an open book test. The test was define the following terms: communication, transportation, and transcontinental. And they couldn't read. I mean, they just stared at the test. Some of the students couldn't read. Others, I guess you could call it marginal reading. But
you had great phonetic spelling. The word back on two of the papers was B-A-K-E. Yeah, it's just tragic. And in contrast, I was with Senator Mountjoy's administrative assistant down near Los Angeles, and she was taken on a tour of one of the schools that had been set up. And this is a matching grant. The poor family still has to pay 50% of the tuition. Some of the single moms are working three jobs to get their kids into these schools, even with the grant. But you can see why, because Peggy was just astounded. She said she walked in, this is South Central Los Angeles, you know, the Watts riots, and they walked into this school, and all of the young men stood. And they stayed standing until the teacher turned to them and said, gentlemen, you may be seated. because Peggy, as a woman, had walked into the room. So that's a stark contrast to the public schools that, you know, have metal detectors and things to keep the guns out.
And riots, yeah, and shootings.
Well, what you had to say about industry now providing scholarships for Christian school students is so very true, although very few people know about it. And it's because they are realizing that a very high percentage of all parents want their children in Christian schools. I was at two graduations when I was in Opelousas, Louisiana. The 8th grade and the 12th grade. And these were at the Westminster Christian Academy, whose registration for next September is already 1,100. So they are successful schools. And I was very much interested during the graduations to be told by those who were seated next to me on the platform, principal or someone else, whoever was next to me, the stories of some of the students, the families they came from. There was one boy, I believe an 8th grader, who won one of the awards, a fine-looking young boy, who had been found 3-4 years earlier living in an abandoned bus, and had been living there for some time. And the doctor who was involved found a home for him. He is highly successful. He will no doubt end up at a university when he finishes high school. There were 37 or 38 from the high school graduating. And these students, and I was told some of them came from extremely modest families. These were black and white students. Every last one of them was headed for a college or a university, and a number of them had scholarships, a surprisingly high number. Well, you can see why businesses are financing such students. They are recognizing that the future of the country rests with these. It was really a marvelous experience to see the caliber of those students and of the future they are making for themselves. Some of them, I was told, came from extremely poor families.
Well, you have a case of California business going out of California to find people qualified for the jobs that are available here. Yes. We have, estimates on what industry spends to re-educate its employees is somewhere between $2 and $6 billion a year.
Yes,
it's incredible. I mean, and it for them, it's a smarter investment to invest in the student while they're in school.
Yeah.
So they'll be a productive employee as soon as they get on the job, as opposed to taking them out of school. I mean, taking them out of the business, teaching them again so that they can be productive.
Well, the military is doing the same thing, re-educating the recruits, because what they found was that a functional illiterate could, in a matter of minutes, destroy millions in equipment simply because he could not read properly. So they test them and they retrain them, re-educate them. I think it's very good that you're promoting this, and certainly there are the industries just in your area that could subsidize any number of such families.
Darren, you're not a protest candidate. You expect to win. Every good candidate has a strategy for winning. What's yours?
Get more votes than his opponent.
That's the way to do it.
Well, a strategy, as I said before, is we need issues that are going to cut across party lines.
And for you, those are?
Those are the education issue, which I think is going to be huge in this coming election. The public schools in Sacramento are at a point of meltdown. They're having riots. Said the article they had in the paper on Sunday, the kids can't even read. And the education department is having a very hard time covering up that fact. Like I said, a lot of the people we have in the district are low income, looking for jobs. The thing we're going to need to do is, it's really going to be an education. We're going to have to educate people. We're going to have to let them realize or teach them what the role of government is. It's not to redistribute wealth. It's to provide an environment so that people can provide for themselves. That'll be a big part of it. And as you know, I was thinking about this, but as I met when I met you at church, this gave me the last kick I needed to get me started. I've started going through the Federalist Papers again. Those were very wise men.
Yes, you noticed that, didn't you?
Yeah. a lot of interesting stuff in there.
Yeah.
The Constitution, going over the founding documents, and I'm going to let Matt Sui's, I can't say that, my opponent.
There you go.
I'm going to let his record defeat him.
You'll have a decided advantage because I'm sure he's never read the Constitution.
Well, and I'm gonna bring that up as often as I can. To let him, like I said, I will come out. My platform is basically pro-family, and the government needs to be providing, like I said, an atmosphere or an environment where the family can survive. And I will show how his record, my opponent's record, is anti-family. I mean, to send, for him to vote for, to keep increasing the debt ceiling, you know, that's destroying our future. To vote to send the money to China, as they call it, population control. We call it coercive abortions.
Yes.
Or he knows that is taking place, and I'm going to ask the simple question: how is that pro-family? And I'm going to let a process of education, but also a process of letting the voters see this man for what he really is, and what I have to offer as, you know, my Christian response to him. And to show what a true conservative, not a conservative who is just, you know, filling the square, saying we're going to cut taxes, you know, we want to, you know, reform welfare, and the joke goes, what's the difference between a conservative and a liberal? It was about 20 years.
Right.
I don't want to, like I said, I basically want to redefine or have a new type of conservatism, as we call it. I mean, a true conservative is a Christian.
Yes.
And that's what I want to bring out in the election.
Interestingly, about the last three decades, the black political leadership in this country, as you know, Theron, by and large has been liberal. How do you think that those whose ideology is much like Jesse Jackson are going to respond to a dynamic, intelligent, young black conservative like you? Although, as you know, there are others, but
very poorly.
Theron had an experience. We were at the Republican convention a few months ago, and they had a Black Caucus on the affirmative action issue, which Theron was anxious to get to, but you were sort of surprised when you arrived, weren't you?
Yes, if I didn't know that I was at the Republican convention, I thought I was at the Democratic convention from what I, from the response I heard. I mean, there's, the response that needs to be given, and I think the only, that I'm capable of doing it because they, there's certain, tactics they can't use against me.
Yes.
Example, when John was at a affirmative action debate, when he started making headway, he just, the person in the audience just said, "You're white.
Yeah.
You can understand racism."
Yeah.
And, you know, and basically retreat into that. Well, he can't do that with me.
Right.
And the answer is, you know, like I said, I will admit to the people that, yes, there are problems. But having handouts is not the solution.
Yeah.
The solution is, and it goes back to some of the things I'm running on, education, entrepreneurship, getting the regulations out of people's way so that they can provide for themselves. And then the last, they're really not going to like, is hard work. I mean, you're going to have to set up a system, and it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take work to do it. The system now... It's funny to me, and I ask people this. I said, "Why you admit that affirmative action is not working? So why are you fighting for it?"
Well, and what you say, the alternative often is not well received because it's hard work. When you became a United Airlines pilot, did you find a full quota of black pilots?
No.
That's an avenue that any ambitious black young man could enlist in the military and go the course that you
right.
have and find himself in a good position.
Right. I've had people attack me in that way, saying that you wouldn't be where you're at unless, you know, if it wasn't for affirmative action. And I answer, well, maybe it got me in the door,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't keep me there.
Yeah.
It didn't keep me at the academy. I asked them, did affirmative action stay up all night with me to write a 30-page term paper?
Right.
Did affirmative action climb into the jet with me when I had to fly my solo flight?
Yeah.
You know, did it get, was affirmative action there? You know, when I did my simulator evaluation, when they were blowing up engines on me and saying, you know, fly this airplane back and land it. No, I answered that I, in high school, prepared myself.
Yeah.
I took the calculus, the trigonometry, and the geometry, and the physics, and everything necessary. So maybe that slot was there because of affirmative action, but I could take advantage of it, so I would have succeeded anyway.
But it's because of affirmative action that you were forced to answer those questions. That's the difficulty, isn't it?
Right. And yes, and that's another problem you have, where there's a stigma.
Exactly. You know, so it harms the people often
It harms the people. It also puts people in a position that are not prepared to take advantage of the situation. It doesn't do the black any good if he is going in for an interview, if he's a product, especially a product of the public schools, if he can't read and write.
Yeah.
You know, I may have 5 slots open for black nuclear physicists, but if they can't read and write, they're not going to get the job.
Yeah.
Whereas if there's someone who's prepared, you know, all you're doing is you're making it, if anything, you're giving me another boost that I don't need.
Yeah.
And you're hurting, you know, a lot of other people. I mean, there's a lot of poor white that are trying to make it. I mean, it's poor across the board. If these people truly wanted a level playing field, then that's what we should have. You know, make it an opportunity for everyone, not, you know, well, we're only going to, you know, help out this group or this group. And then that's another funny aspect of affirmative action, considering 70% of the people in this country are eligible for preferential treatment.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many contradictions in it that, you know, if they do an internal critique of the system, I just ask them, how can you continue to support this? You may not like my solution. If you don't, come up with something better.
Yeah.
I mean, we know what's required to succeed. You need to be educated, you need to have skills, and you need to, you know, when you have the opportunity, you need to take advantage of it. And nobody's going to pick you up and carry you, you know, and spoon feed you, basically. I mean, you're going to have some initiative on your own. You have to work hard.
Baron, what can the Christian community do to assist you in your campaign?
Prayer, first of all. The support I need, I'm looking for, and those were the people I initially went to was the Christian community, because I told them if I can't get Christians to support me, I'm not going to get anybody to support me.
Yeah.
Like I said, right now I'm trying to get volunteers for my grassroots support, and hopefully that will get my name out and let them know, you know, what my platform is, what my stances are on the issues, and, you know, get people talking. And
as I recall, you had a sort of an ingenious financial plan. Rather than having huge donors with huge amounts, you just wanted to get a number of people to support you at a relatively small amount every month.
This is a new system we're trying. We get people to commit to contribute to me on a monthly basis, a small amount. $11 is the way it's set up now for a year, and that helps getting grassroots going. It helps with me going out, letting people know what my issues are that I'm running on, why I'm running. And it gives me the opportunity to just to get out, you know, and verbalize. And everybody's going to ask different questions. For instance, I had someone ask me a question the other day. You know, they said, well, what you're talking about, you know, is going to tear down a lot of industries that have been built up because of this. And, you know, it's going to hurt a lot of people. They're going to be out of work. And I said, that's true. I'm not going to lie to you. But if we have a system, and I answered them by telling them, if we have a system that is built on a corrupt foundation, that, you know, yes, there's people that have vested interest in that system, but if the system's wrong, it needs to be corrected, and we need to build it on a better foundation. And if we have people that really are good businessmen, they really are motivated, they're not going to have any problems finding or work or starting over again. An example I used was affirmative action. Think of all the businesses, the consultants. These people are in business, and they want discrimination to exist because that keeps them in business.
Yeah.
And if we get rid of that, yes, a lot of people are going to be out of business, but I'd say the country's better for it. And the other industries will spring up. Another example would be the buggy whip industry. I mean, the cars came along, and the buggy whip industry went out of business. But yeah, Look what took its place.
Right.
John, are you helping Theron?
He's going to be my congressman. I've got to help him.
Good. Have you set up a committee that people can send their contributions to?
Well, actually, Theron is still in the development stage on that. This is a new approach that we're taking in terms of grassroots, positioning. I don't know if it's appropriate to give a telephone number. If anybody wants to contact us, we can certainly let them know what the progress is and do that.
All right. Why don't you give an address and telephone number both, so they can mail, if they want to, a gift?
Sure.
Because I know I'd like to.
It's the address is 4246 Second Avenue in Sacramento. And it's 95817.
95817. Whom do we address there?
You can just address it to Theron Johnson.
All right.
And check should be to
Vanguard Advantage.
What?
Vanguard, if they're going to send a check, it should be made out to Vanguard Advantage, which is a trust.
Vanguard Advantage?
Advantage.
Bob has asked us to spell Theron's name, so...
T-H-E-R-O-N.
That's an old name. I hadn't heard it until you came into our lives, Theron. But when I was growing up, it was fairly common. That's I don't know the origin, but I suspect it's an old English name.
Well, our prayers that it becomes very prominent once again.
Any last comments you'd like to make, Theron, before we finish? We have just about 4 minutes left, 3 to 4.
I'll just finish briefly on basically the note I started on. The only way for these evil men to succeed is for Christians to stand by and do nothing.
Paul, any last comment you'd like to make?
Well, I'm just really impressed with the freshness and the vitality that Theron has for this task ahead of him. And I wish you the best of luck. I mean, we need people like you to go in and represent us.
Mark?
I'm just excited that I wish I was in your district to vote for you.
Well, you can drive on down and watch some precincts for me.
We could be that.
I want to say something quickly. It is largely because of the writings and influence of Rousseau's John Rushdoony that men like Theron are doing what they're doing. And there's a remarkable revival across the country of the Christian interest in politics. And from a human standpoint, we know it's because of God's sovereignty in his word, but from a human standpoint, we have to thank to a huge degree the writings of Rush. And I mean that very honestly from the depths of my heart.
And it is a broad spectrum of things happening, from what would by anybody's standard be an uphill challenge in an area that is new when taking on these urban districts, but in safe Republican districts where we know a lot of establishment money, we're supporting a fellow down in Southern California, George Runner, for the State Assembly, who's principal of the largest Christian school in Lancaster, California. And he is going to be in another 2 months the hands-on favorite for that race in 1996 with hundreds of Christian volunteers and a bold witness. Matter of fact, one of the headlines in the local paper was Christian candidates may split the vote.
Wow.
Because there's two of them running. But, you know, it is a real Reformation American style going on as people reassert biblical values and become serious about taking back our nation.
Well, thank you all, and Theron, thank you for coming up here.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Good night, and God bless you all.